it's great the Trump administration has walked back some of that. They said, we're not going to bring these kinds of charges, but whoever is in the White House next can undo that, and probably will. You know, the pendulum likes to swing both ways. It will presumably swing the other way soon. Whether people are happy or not with that, that might mean anti-crypto, anti-Bitcoin, and this is something they will probably try again. And if they do, that means we don't get access to the kinds of good wallets we want. We don't get access to Phoenix. We're not going to get access to Lightning wallets. Rollups are dead. Arc, Spark, all of these things that you might have heard of or might not have heard of yet that are coming down the pipeline to wallets to improve the UX, make it really, really usable, make Bitcoin awesome, we can't have as Americans. We can't build in America, and we can't allow others to service to Americans. So we need to get the law changed so that developers, so that people running these kinds of wallets are protected so that we can have access to these things in the U.S.
Greetings and salutations, my fellow plebs. My name is Walker, and this is the Bitcoin Podcast. Bitcoin continues to create new blocks every 10 minutes, and the value of one Bitcoin is still one Bitcoin. If you are listening to this right now, remember, you are still early. Find me on Noster at primal.net/walker and this podcast at primal.net/titcoin. On X, YouTube, and Rumble, just search at Walker America. And find this podcast on X and Instagram at Titcoin Podcast. Head to the show notes for sponsor links. Head to substack.com/@WalkerAmerica to get episodes emailed to you. And head to bitcoinpodcast.net for everything else. Without further ado, let's get into this Bitcoin talk. Matt, glad to have you here. Hopefully you're also relatively recovered from Vegas, but I know you've been hitting the circuit of podcasts, so that can be quite taxing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, I've been on tour, as it were, trying to get the message out. It's been, you know, it's fun. It's fun to hang out, chat Bitcoin with people for an hour at a time, but it also means I don't get my normal work done.
Yeah. And just for, so you are, what is it? You're head of something at Spiral, right?
I don't know. I'm an engineer. I guess I'm the most tenured engineer on the Spiral team. So we work on Lightning. We work on making Lightning more accessible, better for wallets, and hoping to, our real goal is to make Bitcoin the best money. I mean, that's the top, one of Block's top line goals, and to use that within Block, but then our goal at Spiral is to just make Bitcoin the best money.
I still remember, and I mentioned this to you at in Vegas, one of the Bitcoin conference presentations from all the conferences I've been to that has stuck with me the most and that I will just always remember was your talk at TabConf in 2022, I think. That was basically, the premise was like, Lightning screwed, but maybe not, but it is, but maybe not. And I don't know, it was masterful. And I maybe want to revisit some of your theses from that a little bit later on in this, just because I thought that was just a banger of a talk. Also, the keynote that you gave right before, you were the last speaker before Trump went on stage last year, which was amazing because you gave a really important, like, not just some fluffy, you know, NGU talk. You gave like a, hey, this is a thing we need to pay attention to with mining centralization. And you gave it to the most packed house you possibly could have. So I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah.
The most packed house of people on their phones.
Well, okay, fair enough. I was paying attention to it for what it's worth.
And
for sure, some others were as well. That's fair. But okay, today, and like the reason that you had reached out, we chatted at the conference a little bit. You had some very cool hats, which I believe you're wearing now. Yep. Okay. Awesome. So I'm just going to preemptively tell people to go to saveourwallets.org, which I thought initially, just knowing you, I was like, is this going to be some sort of a deep troll? Is this Matt playing some sort of a long game? No. This is very, very real and a very serious thing. So I want to just kind of get right into that to make sure we cover it. Can you tell us, like, what is going on? What is saveourwallets.org? And, like, what are we talking about here? Why is there? Why did you create a website just for this?
Yeah. So in the So most people are familiar with the Samurai and the Tornado Cash cases. The DOJ brought charges against non-custodial wallet, non-custodial platform, saying, oh, you were a money transmitter, which basically is the class of rules that requires KYC, AML, all the stuff that you'd have to do at a bank, all the stuff that you have to do with a custodial institution. And they said, no, even though you were non-custodial, you had to comply with all these laws. It was not possible for them to comply with these laws. The people they were supposed to register with would not have accepted their registration because they didn't think they needed to register. But nonetheless, the DOJ brought these charges. And maybe they'll win in court. The DOJ has now dropped some of those charges. But importantly, it had a chilling effect, right? We saw Phoenix, this great Lightning wallet, decide to pull out of the US market. And a lot of developers were asking questions. So, yeah, it's great. The Trump administration has walked back some of that. They said, we're not going to bring these kinds of charges, but whoever is in the White House next can undo that. And probably will. The pendulum likes to swing both ways. It will presumably swing the other way soon. Whether people are happy or not with that, that might mean anti-crypto, anti-Bitcoin, and this is something they will probably try again. And if they do, that means we don't get access to the kinds of good wallets we want. We don't get access to Phoenix. We're not going to get access to Lightning wallets. Rollups are dead. Arc, Spark, all of these things that you might have heard of or might not have heard of yet that are coming down the pipeline to wallets to improve the UX, make it really, really usable, make Bitcoin awesome. We can't have as Americans. We can't build in America, and we can't allow others to service to Americans.
Which is kind of insane because purportedly we're the freest country in the world.
Supposedly.
It's supposedly, and by many metrics, yes. I forget who it was that described it this way. It may have been Greg Foss, a Canadian who is looking down from our American attic at America, but saying basically, America's the prettiest horse at the glue factory. Like, yeah, it's still a horse at the glue factory, but it's the best looking one there.
Right,
But
right.
this is kind of insane, though, and just. To loop back on one thing you mentioned, because I think this is actually really important for people to realize why the pendulum swinging back and forth actually makes such a difference, and you need actual protections like that are codified into law. The FinCEN basically said, no, this they're not violating anything. Like this doesn't apply. Money transmitter doesn't apply. From our perspective, like no, it's all good. The prosecutors went ahead with it anyway. Knowing that, and I think Sam Shapiro at the BTC Policy Institute has done like a lot to kind of uncover that and showcase. I know a lot of people have. This is just what I've seen, but this is kind of like why there is actually some really dire need to make this stuff happen at a regulatory level. Because if it's just prosecutors from an administration being left up to it, they'll just do whatever they want. Like it doesn't matter what a particular agency says, right?
Totally. Yeah, and there are a lot of prosecutors in the United States. They can make decisions. Obviously their boss can tell them no, but whether they're paying close enough attention. But yeah, more importantly, the next administration, who knows what they're going to do? And so we really need to get the law changed. We need to make it clear that, look, if you're not a custodial platform, you still have to enforce sanctions. You still can't like open a channel with someone in Iran, whatever. But you don't have to do KYC, AML, these things that you can't actually do, right? We're not talking about stuff where it's like, ah, well, these wallets just don't want to do it. It's like, no, they can't. You cannot do AML at that level on Lightning, on any of these platforms. You can't run a Lightning wallet and submit to yearly examinations about whether or not your AML system is up to par. Like, this doesn't, it's not practical. It's not feasible. It's just not a thing. And so we need to get the law changed so that developers, so that people running these kinds of wallets are protected so that we can have access to these things in the US.
And I mean, is this something that potentially has ramifications further than just like if an individual is listening to this and they're thinking, well, okay, maybe some companies need to worry about this. What's the big deal? But like this could conceivably, this kind of precedent could be used to go after just like even individual node runners, right? Who are operating Lightning channels with each other. Like there's no reason, like if they have a bone to pick with you, they can use this as an attack vector,
Oh,
essentially.
totally. Yeah, especially Lightning nodes. Any of these, Yeah, I like to refer to them as ancillary services to non-custodial wallets. So these service providers, these sequencers, these Lightning nodes, you know, sometimes it's decentralized networks, sometimes it's an individual company. They can all be targeted with this kind of reasoning. You know, the DOJ said that a frying pan transmits heat, and thus anyone involved in transmitting any data for a non-custodial wallet as a money transmitter.
Did
That
they
was their
actually
argument.
say
Yes,
that?
that was their argument in the filing, is a frying pan transmits heat and an Ethernet cable transmits data, and thus everyone is a money transmitter. And it's like, well, if you take that to its logical conclusion, your ISP is a money transmitter because they let you use Bitcoin on the network, right? It's absurd how broad they wanted to define money transmission here. And so it needs to be clarified. Like, this is nonsense.
I mean I'm now remembering this because I think there were jokes about stainless steel versus cast iron pans and which was, but it's just like it's just so insane that's an argument that was made by very serious people who can just literally throw you in jail. Like
Right.
that's
Yeah.
those are people that can come and take away your freedom, and they're making arguments based on fucking heat transfer. I mean, that's just nuts. It's just
And you know, they
insane.
can maybe you end up winning in court. It doesn't matter. You still spent 3 years sitting in jail, rotting in a cell, and no developer, no wallet software vendor is going to take that risk. Right. And so, you know, there's a lot of Bitcoiners like, oh, well, we shouldn't let the government, whatever. We should take our freedoms, not, you know, ask the government to change the rules. And that's fair, but no one is going to take that risk for you, right? So you need, in order to use Bitcoin in a way that has not shitty user experience, right? So on Lightning, on Arc, Spark, whatever, on any of these L2s, you need these ancillary services. Maybe they're a company, maybe it's a centralized network, but you need them in order for that wallet to function. And no one is going to take that risk for you because no one wants to sit in a jail cell. Even if they're confident they're going to win on the law, they're not going to want to sit in the jail cell. No developer is going to do that, no wallet vendor, and these things just won't be available to Americans.
And I cannot blame them. I wouldn't want to sit in a jail cell for that, and not even have the like nothing is certain. Once your freedom is stripped away and you are put behind bars. I mean, we just saw, R Ross Ulbricht finally made it out after so many years behind bars. Like nobody wants to be put in that cage, and like
No.
the state does have that ability to exert violence on you. And they will do it. Like it's just the reality. So, with that kind of dark preface to all of this, what's the bright side here in terms of this Blockchain Regulatory Certainty Act?
Yeah. So we have a shot here to fix the law. So two Congress people, Representative Emmer, who is the majority whip, so that's the number two position on the Republican side of the House, for those who aren't familiar with their US civics, and Rep Torres, who is the Democrat from the Bronx, co-introduced the Blockchain Regulatory Certainty Act, which fixes the law. I mean, it's a super straightforward two-page bill. You can go read it. Anyone can read it. It's not complicated. You don't need a legal background to understand everything in there. It just says if you're not a custodian, you're not a money transmitter. You're not regulated as such. You're not regulated as any of this nonsense. And so we need to put pressure on them. We need to call our Congress people. We need to say, look, we need this to pass. And that means we have to work with our friends, or more often enemies, on the crypto side of the house, not the Bitcoin side, and we need to get them pushing it, and they are. We need to work with our friends in Congress and lobbyists who support us, and they are pushing on this too. But ultimately, we need the politicians to feel pressure from the voters. People need to pick up the phone and call their representatives. I know it sounds cliche, but it does work. It takes 5 minutes of your time. You just local you go to saveourwallets.org, you type in your zip code, it'll pull up all the phone numbers for you. You know, you've got two senators and a House member, you hit all three of them, you just pick up the phone, you say, hi, if you haven't heard of the Blockchain Regulatory Certainty Act, I think it's really important. It fixes some issues in the law where there's regulations that people cannot possibly comply with, and they shouldn't be subject to jail time in exchange for not complying with something they can't comply with. And then you hang up the phone, you go about your day. And they listen. You know, they do feel they most senators and representatives don't have good information about what their constituents want. And most of them want to turn their place in Congress into a lifetime career, for better or for worse. They want to stay there forever. And so if you tell them, look, you vote yes on this, or I'm not going to vote for you, they do listen. If they see, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 people calling in, they're like, oh, actually, a lot of people care about this. It doesn't take much, because not that many people actually do it. Not many people pick up the phone and call.
It's very true. And it's like, if they see that there are highly motivated people who are taking that 5 minutes, even though it's easy, you're right. Most people just don't even take that step, because there's honestly not that many things that most people care about enough to take that step. And so it's like, it can actually move the needle. They will pay attention, because honestly, I feel that with politicians, it's like they have so many people asking them for so many things all the time. They need to have a way to filter that. And usually the way to filter things is, okay, how many people are complaining about this? Like, how big of a problem is this going to be for me down the road? Is this an economically important group of people who are also complaining about this? They can probably logically make some assumptions there. So I would encourage people, again, just to go to saveourwallets.org and to check this out. It's a really nice little site as well here, but it breaks it down. The bill is linked there. It's all pretty, as you said. I mean, it's a super short bill. I had it up here earlier, but it's like literally like 2 pages. And can you break down, just like, for the bill, I mean, how does this actually protect developers, though? Like, is this something that if it's passed through, does this actually offer the kind of protections that are needed?
Yeah, I mean, it's super clear and pretty comprehensive. It says very explicitly, and it has a legal definition of what non-custodial means. But it's a pretty reasonable definition. I think it passes the smell test of what people understand non-custodial to mean. But it says very explicitly, if you are a service provider or a software developer, and there may be one other category, and you are non-custodial, then you are not subject to money transmission laws, you are not considered a money transmitter as defined in federal law, and you're not a financial institution. So you're not regulated as a financial institution, i.e. you don't have to do all the AML, KYC and stuff. It doesn't protect people from sanctions. There's like one or two other things that are strict, but that you can actually comply with, and that, you know, you hope prosecutors will be reasonable about, but things that you actually could comply with. If you're like an LSP, you could not open channels to people in Iran, right? It'd be great if we didn't have those rules, but we're not fixing that. But it does fix very specifically the Samurai case, where they were charged with money transmission. They were also charged with money laundering, but that charge is harder without the transmission case. Money laundering is a weird thing. You normally have to charge someone with a crime and then money laundering on top. Just charging money laundering is harder. But for the most, you know, unless that's a thing you're doing, and like running a mixer might still be challenging, but non-custodial wallets, very specifically, you're not a money transmitter, you're not a financial institution. And that's really the thing that people are worried about. That's why Phoenix left the United States after the Samurai charges. And that's why LSPs aren't as plentiful as they should be. You know, we'd have a lot more competition for non-custodial Lightning wallets if we had this kind of protection. Frankly, I've looked into running an LSP for people. Not that I have boats of, you know, buckets of Bitcoin, but enough that I could run an LSP at least for developers to test on and whatnot. And without this, I'm not comfortable doing it. But with this, I'm very comfortable running an LSP.
And like the TLDR on this is basically this line right here, that's, you're not going to be designated as, you know, any of these things unless you have control over digital assets to which a user is entitled under the blockchain service or the software created, maintained, or disseminated by the blockchain developer or provider. So basically, if you're not in control of user funds, you're good. That's essentially what it boils down to, right?
That's it. Yeah, that's really all it is. Not a complicated bill, straightforward, and it protects developers and wallet vendors against a very specific and a very real threat that they're worried about.
If you're stuck spending dollars, at least stop earning dirty fiat rewards. Use Fold to earn Bitcoin on everyday purchases and regular expenses. Like groceries, bills, travel, home improvement. I literally just earned 2,203 sats buying a $100 Amazon gift card on Fold. You don't even need to use the Fold card itself if you don't want to. You can connect your favorite credit card and double dip with Bitcoin rewards on merchant offers. Or go all in. Make Fold the center of your personal finances. Buy, earn, save, and even get paid in Bitcoin with Fold. Head to the link in the show notes to get started with the ultimate savings toolkit. Or go directly to use.foldapp.com/r/walker and get yourself $10 in Bitcoin when you sign up. Let's talk about using Bitcoin the way it's meant to be used. Self-custodial, lightning fast, and ready for the real world. That's exactly what BitKit Wallet is all about. BitKit Wallet is a clean, powerful Bitcoin and Lightning mobile wallet that gives you full control on-chain and on Lightning. You hold the keys always. Whether you're brand new or are a seasoned Bitcoiner, BitKit's intuitive wallet design makes it simple to send, receive, and manage your sats. QuickPay lets you fire off Lightning payments faster than ever, and seamless integration between on-chain and Lightning means your funds are always where you need them. It's your daily driver Bitcoin and Lightning wallet, and it actually feels good to use it. And with modular widgets, you can personalize your experience to match your style. There's even a Lightning node running right on your phone. No custodians, no compromises. Go to bitkit.to or search BitKit Wallet in your app store and start using Bitcoin like it's meant to be used. That's BITKIT.to. If you've accepted that we're living through the fourth turning, then it's time to get yourself some Bitcoin and then go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker for 5% off the easy-to-use, fully open-source, Bitcoin-only Bitbox O2 hardware wallet. Then get your Bitcoin off the exchange into your own self-custody and prepare yourself for the chaos that is to come. The world is going pretty wild right now, but Bitcoin is ripping, and your stack will soon be worth a heck of a lot more in fiat value than it is today as every currency around the world hyperinflates. So now is the perfect time to get your security locked down tight with Bitbox. I really want to emphasize that the Bitbox O2 is easy as hell to use, whether you're brand new to Bitcoin, it's your first time setting up a hardware wallet, or you are a well-seasoned psychopath. It is Bitcoin only and fully open source. No need to trust me. You can head to their GitHub and verify that for yourself. When you go to bitbox.swiss/walker and use the promo code Walker, not only do you get 5% off, but you also help support this podcast. So thank you.
Yeah. I mean, to me, this just seems like such a common sense thing.
Yeah.
Like, it seems that the Biden DOJ was just, I mean, being very almost just like malicious. Like this seems like one of those cases where it's like, we're going to make an example of you, so you best not do it again unless you want to end up like these guys.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there were definitely a number of groups within the Biden administration who thought that crypto and Bitcoin, which of course they considered all to be one thing, were bad, should be destroyed, and we should use anything at our disposal to do so. You know, Gensler at the SEC, obviously that didn't affect Bitcoin as much, but here in the DOJ, they were really coming after Bitcoin as well. And we don't know what the next administration is going to bring. It might be that again, right? So we need to try to front run it a little bit, keep it from happening. And we just need to make clear to the Senate and to our Congress people that this is a priority. You know, maybe they would pass if it got a vote, but it's hard to get a vote. We have to make sure that they know that this is worth their very limited floor time to debate this, bring it up, and bring it to a vote, either individually or as a part of a larger package. But either way, we need to all make sure that they hear us.
I think that the difficult thing that people need to understand, too, is that it's like precedent that is set now becomes a huge pain in the ass forever, like essentially. So if we don't, like now is when it's easier to fight back against these things from a regulatory standpoint, because it's still kind of like people are still figuring it out.
Yeah.
But one of the ways they figure it out is by setting precedent. And if all of this goes through kind of unchallenged, then it's like, well, okay, this is just how we treat this stuff now. So,
yep.
You know, any of you, you like, we're just going to toss you unlicensed money transmitters into jail. And I mean, I think the frustrating thing about this is like, as a citizen, like you want there to be as much innovation as possible, as many companies building cool and, you know, useful products for you to use as possible. This kind of treatment of open source developers and non-custodial, you know, wallet developers, it literally just, all it makes them do is do what Phoenix did. Like, okay, we're going to leave then. Like, we're not going to go risk jail time. And I think that's like, that's such a shame. Like, that's not the environment we should be fostering. Like nobody wants that environment. No one. I mean, except for maybe some like people suffering from a totalitarian temptation that they can't quite explain. They're like, they're in their Elizabeth Warren phase and they're just like, I need to suck all the freedom out of the room as fast as possible. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Or people
that,
who want to drive all the crypto assets and Bitcoin into custodial platforms so that they can be controlled that way. You know, this, if it limits non-custodial platforms, everyone's going to go to Coinbase. And to your point earlier about, you know, getting the precedent right now, I think it's important to recognize that a lot of countries tend to follow the US when it comes to their regulatory approach. So if the US says, screw this non-custodial thing, we're going to ban this, we're going to make it, you know, really hard to have a good non-custodial wallet, well, a lot of other countries are going to look at that and say, oh, look, the US did that, this makes sense, we're going to do the same. And so it's not just the US. Obviously, Europe's already trying that, and they're all way down there, way down that road. But many other countries will follow what the US does here. And so if we take a stand and say, no, non-custodial is fine, custodial will regulate, that gets monitored very closely, whatever, but non-custodial is fine, then that will probably take hold across a decent portion of the globe.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that it does, because again, it's so much of this stuff just seems like it should be common sense. It seems like this shouldn't even be a debate. Like, of course, if you're not controlling any sort of customer funds or, you know, user funds, of course you're not, shouldn't be slapped with these ridiculous, you know, legal categorizations. But apparently it's very non-obvious to people, or they pretend that it's non-obvious either way. I'm curious too. So, I mean, I saw just right before we hopped on here, I saw that like all of the different, basically both Bitcoin and crypto kind of advocacy groups, or, you know, policy groups, have basically joined together to issue some statements around this, which is nice to see like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, granted it's like, okay, you know, don't shitcoin, it's bad for you. But it's not, like, ultimately this, the fact that these laws or these actions do affect everyone building in this space, at least hopefully some of that, you know, sweet shitcoin money flows through the lobbying channels and maybe benefits Bitcoin in some way. So yeah, at least there's that, right?
They spend a lot of money on lobbying, and we as Bitcoiners don't. And they spend a lot of money lobbying about the SEC and securities regs and whatever, and we don't care about that. That doesn't help us. And so it is nice to get a little bit of their money and a little bit of the air in the room going towards something that affects all of us, including Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's a nice change of pace versus just them trying to fund Bitcoin smear campaigns.
Thanks.
So, I mean, yeah, right. But hey, at least this, I mean, it was, I did not know if I was, you know, going to get to see the skull of Satoshi in person, but that was pretty cool. Not cool that they did it, and like, screw them for it. And I will never forgive or forget, because you just pre-mined all of your tokens out of thin air, then use it to fund disinformation campaigns when you dump on retail. Right. But at least we got that cool piece of art. Cause like, shout out to the artist, incredible piece of art.
Yeah. True.
And fuck you, Brad Garlinghouse. But anyway, but that's beside the point. So, okay. Is there anything else on this in terms of like, are any kind of like, are there deadlines people should be aware of? Is there anything that like actionable stuff? Just, I want to make sure we really drain this. If there's anything else you like want people to know on this.
No, I mean, I think, you know, we want to get this done this Congress. Obviously, you know, who knows what will happen in the midterms in another year and a half. So, you know, we want Congress to feel the pressure now. We wanted to get it done, but yeah, I mean, I think it's the most important thing happening in Bitcoin right now. Certainly the most important thing that everyone in Bitcoin can contribute to by picking up the phone and calling their reps. But I think that's about it, even though it's super important. It's just not a complicated issue.
Right. Which is nice. Like, it's easy to wrap your head around.
Right.
Okay. So that's actually kind of a perfect, a perfect transition here, because you said this is like the most important thing happening right now. There are obviously a lot of debates going on within the Bitcoin community right now, if we can call it that. Presumably then, just given your last statement, you would say that those other debates are not as important as this one. I'm very curious what you think as far as what is the signal right now versus what is the noise amongst these various debates that are going on, whether it be around filtering and this, you know, knots versus core, which I think is somewhat of a false dichotomy, but or if it's about perhaps the most important thing is sats versus bits versus just, you know, versus Bitcoin. I don't know if. To me, that's not the most important thing. I enjoy sats, but also, you know, call them whatever you want. Label them in your app however you want. What else are people being distracted by versus what else should they maybe pay attention to a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think on the, you're right. On the filtering debate, it's a weird dichotomy. It's a 10-year-old debate now. Probably more. So I'll admit that I'm a little tired of it. I've had it a few times. I know there's a lot of Bitcoiners who this is their first go around, so they're excited by it, but I'm a little tired. I think a lot has been written there. I think Bitcoin Core has a PR up to put up a blog post that explains, I think in very clear terms, their the way the mempool works from their point of view, and I think it is super straightforward and easy to understand. So when that comes out, I encourage people strongly to go read that. Hopefully they'll post it in the next day or two. And I don't know that I have a lot more to add on that debate, but yeah, I mean, I think it's such a distraction. There's no amount of screaming about that is going to change anything. It is what it is, whether you like it or not. No amount of screaming is going to change it. And no amount of Bitcoin Core changes is going to change reality there either. It just kind of is what it is. So I find that to be quite a distraction. On bits, sats, and Bitcoin, I don't know, man. I think the ship has sailed, but people are going to push it anyway. Certainly, I have always held the view that more experimentation in user experiences built around Bitcoin is good. That is part of the way we look to achieve our mission at Spiral. We want to provide software that enables people to build a great non-custodial wallet, and that enables more experimentation of different user experiences to see what resonates with people and what gets people really using Bitcoin. And you know, I mean, our goal is that hopefully by the end of the year, if not the middle of next year, you will be able to go on Replit, ask it to build you a Bitcoin wallet, and it's going to build you a super slick non-custodial Bitcoin wallet that works, has instant payments, low fees, and is super reliable, and you can build whatever user experience you want, and then we can see what actually works in the marketplace. That's our top line goal right now. So I'm excited for that. But yeah, I mean, on bits and sats and whatever, I don't know, man. I'm not a user experience person. It does seem like the fragmenting the user experience is only worse, but hey, what do I know?
Yeah. And what about, are there any other topics, I mean, that you think are worthy of consideration right now?
Yeah.
When it comes to like these internal debates that Bitcoiners have?
I mean, there's a lot going on in Bitcoin. I think that the debates are very often not the point. Like, you know, there's always a lot of debates going on in Bitcoin about this or that or whatever. In general, I find them to almost always be distractions. Like, you know, certainly the block size wars was not a distraction. That was really about how to define Bitcoin, and that there was a lot of, as painful as it was, there was a lot of value in having that debate and pushing through those wars. But for the most part, I think most debates in Bitcoin tend to be a distraction. But there is a lot going on in Bitcoin. There's more developers building Bitcoin applications than there ever have been. There continues to be a very slow but non-trivial growth in available resources for developers and funding for developers. Tons of new protocols and things coming out, whether it's roll-ups and L2s, whatever you think of some of those going in the shitcoining on Bitcoin direction, some of them going in the providing better privacy direction, though, which is cool, or Arc and other new L2s that aren't roll-up based. Plus, I think Lightning is finally getting good this year. I mentioned earlier, but I really think the non-custodial Lightning wallets that are going to ship in the middle of next year, based on the work we do on LDK at Spiral, are going to be really, really good. I mean, I know a lot of people wrote off Lightning for a lot of very good reasons. Non-custodial Lightning has sucked, but it's getting there, and we finally do have a lot of the pieces in place, and we'll have the pieces in place over the next few months to really make it awesome. So there's a lot of really great work being done. It's just that a lot of the plebs, either people who are developers or maybe more importantly, just don't have a ton of time. This isn't their full-time job. They don't have a ton of time to contribute to Bitcoin. Don't really get to help with some of these things. And so a lot of people want to just have debates because it's very understandable and it's easy and you can feel like you're doing something and not sure that you always are.
Well, I'd love to dig into the Lightning piece a little bit because again, that talk you gave, and I'll link it in the show notes for people. I'm sure I can find it on YouTube. But basically, yeah, Lightning's screwed, but it's not screwed, but it's screwed, but it's okay. Maybe if you could give the high level premise for that talk, like what led you to give it, and then kind of how has your view of Lightning either evolved or shifted or changed since then?
I think when I gave that talk, oh, you said 2022 is probably something around then.
I think so.
Probably. I think Lightning was a little overhyped. There was a lot of like Lightning is perfect, Lightning is super secure, you're on a node, you don't have to worry about it, whatever, whatever. And I think there were a lot of very big open hairy questions about Lightning, including in the security model, including in the trust model. I think many times in that talk, I told people like you probably should never open a channel with someone you don't trust, at least kind of trust. You don't have to like think they're the best person in the world, but they're at least not going to go to a lot of effort to take your money. And I think since then, the community's come around the other way, and now Lightning sucks. Lightning is broken. Lightning will never grow. It's just a way for custodial platforms to settle money, and then maybe it's a way for other L2s that people actually use to settle. Whether it's you're using eCash or Spark or Arc or whatever, you're gonna pay people over Lightning. I'm gonna, pull a little bit of a cliche and pretend that my view hasn't shifted. I've been rock solid, and the community was here, and now the community's here, and I'm still chilling in the middle. But I think, a lot of the stuff that was in that talk too was, here's a big problem. It's really hairy. We think we have a solution kind of right here, and we have to figure it out, and we have to go build it. And it's a lot of work to build it. And now, for many of them, not everything, but for many of those big hairy problems, we do have solutions, and we have them built or almost built. The biggest one really being these pinning attacks. So Lightning has this like really weird, OG Lightning has this really weird trust model where, we're creating all these transactions, but we're not broadcasting them right away. That's like classic Lightning. We're creating these transactions, we're updating them all the time, and then eventually we'll broadcast it later. The problem is we got to put a fee on that transaction. We're building these transactions every minute or whatever. We're assigning a fee, and that fee needs to be sufficient to get into a block at some point in the future that we don't yet know. And obviously, if you follow Bitcoin fee estimates or you go to mempool.space every now and again, you notice that the fee does fluctuate. And sometimes the fee fluctuates a lot. Sometimes the fees spike up, hundreds, 100x over one day because somebody's doing something crazy and they put a lot of transactions on the chain. So creating transactions that have a fixed fee rate now for inclusion in the chain some point later where we don't know what the fee rate's going to be then is not a solvable problem. It's not just a hard problem. It's like we can't solve it. And over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, Lightning has done some work at changing the protocol, but also Bitcoin Core has rethought how they deal with transactions in the mempool to address this problem for Lightning, and it also fixes problems for other, related problems for other L2s. And so Bitcoin Core now, as of I think the latest release, maybe the one before it, when you take a transaction, when nodes send transactions to each other, you know, that you're sending a transaction, they're like, okay, I got this transaction. I'm going to see if I want to put it in my mempool and then relay it onwards. Now nodes are able to look at multiple transactions at once. So a node is able to say, hey, Walker, you know, your peer can say, hey, Walker, hey, I've got some transactions for you. Instead of sending one, it sends two. And now your node can look at those two transactions and can say, okay, I'm going to look at the overall fee rate of both of the transactions together and not just one at a time. And that lets us play fun games like assigning zero fee on these transactions in Lightning that we update all the time, and then hanging another transaction off of them that pays for them. And so the second transaction can have a high fee, it pays for that transaction, but nodes have to relay them together so that nodes can say, okay, these two transactions together make sense, even if the first one didn't. And that's a huge change. You know, as you might imagine, there's a lot of parts of Bitcoin Core involved in looking at transactions when they get added to the mempool. To be able to now look at buckets of transactions instead of singular transactions was a lot of work, a lot of research and development, a lot of thinking about all kinds of crazy denial of service attacks, a lot of thinking about ways people could break these things. And it took 2, 3, 4 years for Bitcoin Core to finally conclude some of that work. Some of it's still ongoing. There's more work to be done there. But, you know, fixing these things was hard. And so I think the point of the talk was to point out, like, these things are hard. We might have solutions for some of them. Some of them we might not have solutions for. Some of them are unsolvable. Most of them we can fix, but there's a lot of work to be done. And I think now we're in a position where we can say, okay, actually, we've done most of the work we needed to do. It's not 100% there, but over the next, I think, 6 to 12 months, it's going to be mostly there. Not in all Lightning nodes, but certainly in LDK, and for the folks using LDK-based wallets, those features that we needed to make Lightning good are finally there.
Which is great. Like, the fact that you, like, to hear your positivity on it is fantastic, because again, like, what I enjoy about you, Matt, is that you're always very realistic and balanced about things. Like, no one would accuse you of overly hyping something, you know, to put it mildly. That's fantastic. And I do think that it is funny, now that you kind of pointed out, like, I'm remembering in kind of that 2022 era where it was a lot more talk about how great Lightning was, and Lightning is, like, it is ready and it's good to go, and we're, you know, it's perfect. And it wasn't. And now it's kind of like, you hear, there's a lot of, like, Lightning, like, doomerism now, and just people, you know, trying to dunk on Lightning, when it from just as a casual user of Lightning and of a bunch of different Lightning wallets in a lot of different contexts, it's pretty incredible now. And, like, from what you're saying, like, it's going to get better. Like, it's funny how narratives change, I guess, but I'm glad to see it underhyped then, I guess, currently. Maybe that's a good thing. A little bit less hype is not going to be bad.
Yeah. And it'll take a while as wallets start to adopt the newer technologies. I mean, I think, you know, over the next few months, the good Lightning wallets are going to get really good. And the ones that maybe aren't as actively maintained or made some technical decisions that are harder for them to pivot are going to stay okay. But over the next, you know, as they all start to catch up, it's going to be, I think, really good. I think the user experience is finally going to be great.
And hopefully just, like, more options. Because, I mean, for a while, even like Wallet of Satoshi was such a widely used wallet. And then they obviously, they're a custodial wallet, to clarify, for anyone who is not familiar. And they left, they ceased operating. I mean, you could still access the wallet if you were using a VPN. Like, you know, it was fine. But, like, for all intents and purposes, they were not available to folks in the U.S., you know, because they were worried, again, about the whole money transmitter thing. Now they're coming back. They're saying, we've got a non-custodial option. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but just more broadly, it's like, okay, it's nice for people to have more than just, like, one option. Like, we should have a bunch of custodial options and a bunch of non-custodial options, and you should be able to easily choose. Like, yeah. And they should be nice experiences versus, like, well, here's the one custodial option that we can still use. And, oh, you can get a hold of this non-custodial one if you want, but the developers fled. So, like, who knows? Like,
I don't know. It feels like we're in a better place now for that, at least. But you have any thoughts on the Wallet of Satoshi thing?
Yeah, I mean, the BRCA is needed here. And again, you know, our goal on Spiral is really that we want everyone to be able to YOLO a good, secure, non-custodial wallet with an LLM and Replit and just, like, build me my own non-custodial wallet. And it'll be good. That's our goal. By the middle of next year, that's really our goal, is that it'll just work. It'll be great. And we'll have real competition there. On non-custodial, on Wallet of Satoshi specifically, my speculation, and I haven't gotten this confirmed, is that they're using Spark, which is LightSpark's new, not custodial, but also not non-custodial, Bitcoin L2. So it's a really interesting product. I think it's really cool. And for low balances, I think it makes a lot of sense. For a balance where you can't really open a non-custodial wallet, it makes a lot of sense. But it is fully trusted. So it's this really weird dynamic where you trust their server to delete keys, so that, you know, as you transact, they're deleting old keys, and you trust them to do that. And if they don't do that, then they can potentially take your money. But if they do that, they're not a custodian. They don't have an active key on their server that someone could hack into, take the key, and then take your money. Right? So it's not, it has a very different trust model in practice, so it is in practice much safer, but it is still fully trusted. You're still trusting their server to do the thing correctly, and
So it's somewhere kind of in the middle.
It's definitely not custodial, because they don't have a key that has the money that they could get hacked or whatever. But it's not non-custodial either, because you don't have the key. You don't have the only right to your money either. Like, it's somewhere in the middle. It's a weird middle ground, but it's a really cool middle ground. It's cool that people can build a middle ground. And then on top of that, you know, I think, so on the Spiral team, we similarly are looking at using Spark for some things. And very specifically, our goal over the next number of months is to start thinking about what a wallet looks like when you have both a custodial, or at least this trusted thing, and a non-custodial option. Because, you know, if your wallet only has 1,000 sats, if you opened a new wallet, you linked your Noster, and you received a 21 sat zap, you can't, there's not, no non-custodial wallet makes sense. You can't have 21 sats in a non-custodial wallet, even with an LSP. They're not going to allocate money into that channel. It doesn't make sense. And so you need something custodial there, or at least trusted. And Spark is a really cool option because it's not really custodial. And it doesn't have that really bad trust model of, like, they could get hacked and the money taken, but it is still fully trusted, so we're not going to call it non-custodial. And then if you get a decent balance, if you get, you know, 10,000 sats or whatever the threshold is for, you know, a wallet could pick a different threshold, you open a Lightning channel and you go to an LSP and you say, hey, look, I've already got this money. I don't need you to allocate any liquidity to me. Just open a channel to me and I'll put this money in my channel. And so it really makes for a nice wallet across different balances. So you don't have to, like, pick, oh, well, I'm going to have low balance, so I need to pick a custodial wallet. Or, oh, I'm going to have, you know, a whole Bitcoin in there, so I need a non-custodial wallet because I don't want it to get stolen. It lets just one wallet service both roles. And okay, maybe if you have 1,000 Bitcoin or 100 Bitcoin, you're not going to use this kind of wallet. You hopefully have some kind of offline, air gapped, whatever. But for a spending wallet, or for a wallet that only has some savings, I think it makes a lot of sense. And as Lightning continues to mature and we address these issues that where the protocol bleeds into the user experience and it leads to a really bad user experience, as we address these issues, then having this wallet with both sides is just going to be super seamless. You shouldn't have to notice any of this, because Lightning is going to be totally reliable on this side, Spark is going to be totally reliable on this side, and the wallet's going to get you the best trust model that makes sense given your balance at all times, and it's just going to work.
I feel like I kind of glossed over something that you mentioned earlier, where basically you said we're, like, if I heard this correctly, like 6 to 12 months away from, like, basically somebody like me being able to vibe code my own
Lightning wallet. Is that kind of what you were getting at, basically? Like,
yeah,
that's really cool.
That's our goal. That's definitely our goal. And I'm not going to promise 12 months on that. In 12 months, I think we're going to be there, but I'm going to say 18 months just because things slip. I think we're going to have a really good product in the next 12 months, certainly. Whether it'll be good enough for you to just vibe code something and have it be secure and robust, maybe. Certainly in 18 months, by late summer of next year or fall of next year, yeah, you're going to be able to vibe code your own Bitcoin wallet, and it's going to be a good wallet.
That's wild to think about. I mean, do you envision a future where it's like there are innumerable different, wallet implementations because everybody's building kind of a wallet that works, or maybe not everybody is, but more and more people are able to build out a wallet that has the functionality and the features that they are looking for, like specifically, or do you think we still do these things sort of like, is it like a winner take most where we still kind of trend towards like a couple of big players?
I assume there'll be a handful of big players. I mean, at some point there's some social value in like, okay, well, this is the one that a bunch of people reviewed the code and it's not going to steal your money and whatever. If we really had a million of them and everyone was using their own, then half of them would steal everyone's money, and that's not a great outcome either.
Right.
But aside from that, I think, there's going to be quite a few. And I think what it's really going to do is it's going to enable a lot of experimentation. If you are a hardcore Bits Maxi or a Sats Maxi or whatever, you can go build a wallet and say, look at this wallet. Look how great the user experience is. I can demo it. It works. It's super slick. It's as slick as all the other wallets. But look how great this feature of the wallet is, where I think I'm really delivering a better user experience. And then it lets people build more innovative things. Allows for more innovation to say, well, I think that there should be a Bitcoin wallet with a built-in chat bot, and you pay for the chat bot with Lightning or whatever. I mean, I know that's a common example now. I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't have a million ideas, but we're going to really enable people to experiment with all kinds of different clever things. And that's going to really unlock things in Bitcoin, I hope.
Can I ask you, I don't know if I've actually heard the story, and if you're cool with telling it, how did you actually get into developing in Bitcoin in the first place? Do you mind telling that story?
No, totally. I was in high school.
Wild.
And Bitcoin got to the front page of Slashdot a few times. If you're not old enough to know what Slashdot is, Slashdot was Reddit before Dig was Reddit. That's Dig with two G's. So there's been a few of these kind of link sharing sites throughout history, and Slashdot was the cool one at the time. It was a little more tech focused. Bitcoin got to the front page a few times over the course of late 2010, early 2011. I ended up hearing about Bitcoin from a podcast that I watch regularly, but they heard about it from Slashdot. There was kind of a flood of technologist people who got involved in Bitcoin all at the same time in early 2011 to mid 2011. And I just found it fascinating. I mean, I knew some things. I was a high school kid. I didn't really know how to code. I didn't really know whatever. I just kind of thought this was really cool. We could like build a money and like send each other money based on purely on the software that we were writing, and not have to trust anyone else. No one else was involved in us sending each other money, and we were building this money for the internet. I thought that was really, really cool, and I wanted to work on it. And luckily, at the time, a few other folks got involved in Bitcoin at the same time, who were just brilliant. I mean, who were, Greg Maxwell, Peter Wulla, folks who were senior engineers, had been doing software engineering for many, many years, and were more than happy to volunteer their time to teach some random kid like me stuff about software engineering. And so I learned from super brilliant people. I got to hang out with super brilliant people in IRC and work on a project I thought was fascinating. So I kept doing that through college, joined Blockstream out of college, did that for a few years during Chaincode. Now it's Spiral. So I've bounced around basically my whole career between positions doing Bitcoin research lab kind of stuff, just write good software to make Bitcoin better. I've been very fortunate enough to be paid to do that my entire career. I guess Probably more than a decade now. I've been doing it full time, and I've been working on Bitcoin for almost 15 years.
That's wild. Oh, happy almost anniversary. Thanks for sharing that. I mean, that's just very cool. I mean that, so you were not you were still very green when it came to your developer skills when you first discovered Bitcoin and started trying to learn about it.
Yeah, I have one of the best defenses for I'm not Satoshi. I didn't know what a pointer was in 2011, so I clearly did not write any of this code that is totally impossible.
It's good to have plausible deniability these days because it seems the Satoshi accusations really get
And
tossed around
they
a
really do
lot.
these days, yeah.
It's absurd. Well, thank you again for sharing that because I want to ask another question of you based on another one of your talks, which was again this pre-Trump talk that you had, which was essentially around what I, if I'm remembering correctly, what you viewed as one of the greatest, if not the greatest, risks to Bitcoin, which is miner centralization, specifically mining pool centralization. Some of this, basically, we can get into the template side of that too. Have you seen any improvement in that since then? As far as I understand, the situation's still not very great. Where are you at with that?
Yeah.
Is this still in your mind like one of the, or if not the greatest, like long-term risk to Bitcoin?
It definitely is a major risk. It is definitely one of the biggest risks to Bitcoin, I think. I will say that we are starting to see little shoots of grass poke through the dirt here. On the stratum, so the fundamental issue, to set context, is that in Bitcoin, the network, the thing that gives Bitcoin value is that there's this censorship resistance property. Like you own your Bitcoin. No one can take that from you. No one can stop you from sending your Bitcoin to whoever you want. And it is your Bitcoin. You don't have to trust anyone else in order to use it. And that's great unless there's, let's say, two pools that control more than 51% of the network, or three that control something like 70 or 80%, right? Which is the case today. If you combine Ant Pool with all of their proxies and then Foundry, it's almost more than 50%. It's close to 50%, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. That's not good. And that can potentially impact this censorship resistance property, which I think is really a major part of where Bitcoin gets its value. So what does this mean? So it is not the case that this is fundamental to the design of a pool. Right? A pool says, okay, we have all these miners, you're going to mine, we're only going to find a block every so often, we're going to split the reward of the block across all the miners proportional to their hash rate. This is a simple business. This does not require that they select the transactions that go in the block. That is a technical shortcut that was done because it's an easier way to implement this business, but that's not required. There have been various proposals throughout Bitcoin's history to remove that requirement, to say, okay, we can have a pool where the individual miners are selecting the transactions, and the pool still does this reward splitting thing. We now have a few pools that actually enable this. So there's Ocean, obviously, very publicly, which is Luke's pool. They don't have any kind of real material hash rate to speak of. There's a little bit of hash rate there. They've invented their own protocol, their own proprietary protocol for this, that other pools don't use. But it does enable this, and that's really good for Bitcoin's decentralization. There's also Stratum v2, which is a slightly older protocol standard that I wrote with the Brains, which is the former Slush Pool company, CEO and CTO were co-authors on that. They, for business reasons, don't currently allow miners to select their own transactions, sadly, at Brains. But there's a new pool called Demand, which is launching kind of in beta right now, which does allow transaction selection. And then, so these early shoots of small pools enabling this has created a little bit of noise within the mining community. And I like to pretend that I also had a part in that, which with my main stage talk you talked about in Nashville last year, where I really tried to hammer this issue home, as well as some podcasts, trying to really talk to miners and say, this is a major issue. You need to fix this. And so There's Stratum V2. The software is finally becoming ready, and I know they're talking to a number of pools who are hearing from some of their miners that they want this, and so hopefully that starts to become an option at some of the larger pools and some of the moderate-sized pools over the next number of months. And then almost entirely flew under the radar, Bitmain announced in Vegas at a side event that they were going to start enabling their miners to select the transactions in their block. Totally under the radar, somehow didn't get picked up by almost any media in Bitcoin or podcasts or whatever. I haven't seen people talking about it, but that is possibly the biggest announcement that was made in Vegas by an order of magnitude. That's huge for Bitcoin. It's Bitmain. We don't know what protocol they're using. They haven't said anything. They haven't provided any details. Who knows? Maybe it's something they will launch in 5 years. Maybe it's already running. We don't have any idea what's going on, but they said, the fact that they even committed and said, look, we think this is important enough that we want to do this is huge.
I did not hear about that. Clearly, I was too busy being Vegas.
It was at some side event that I saw one tweet about it and that was it.
Wow. Well, that's if they follow through with that, that's pretty massive, though.
Absolutely massive. Yeah. I mean, it would take the largest Bitcoin pool by far and totally decentralize it. Now, of course, their miners have to switch their software stack and they have to start using it, but it makes that an option. It makes it possible to totally decentralize. Okay. 90% decentralize one of the largest pools in Bitcoin, or the largest pool in Bitcoin. That's huge.
Do you think they're coming at that from an altruistic perspective of we want Bitcoin we want what's best for Bitcoin? Is there another potential ulterior motive? I mean, or is it just that, hey, look, if Bitcoin pools are too centralized and you don't have this, this optionality here, well, ultimately that's not good for Bitcoin, which is not good for our bottom line down the road. So, hey, the game theory of Bitcoin just works out that way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Asking you to speculate here,
obviously, Bitmain has a long history of making decisions that look to be very bad for Bitcoin, but good for Bitmain's bottom line. So I'm not going to give them undue credit for suddenly having had a change of heart and just wanting to do what's best for Bitcoin. I think there is now at least some non-zero demand from miners to enable this. They might be feeling a little bit of heat from the competition of Ocean. Again, Ocean is almost no hash rate, so I don't know how much they care. But maybe they have some miners saying hey, look, here's this feature. I care about this. I want to use it. Why are you not offering this service? I could also take credit and say I got up on the main stage in Nashville last year and put up a multi-headed monster and pointed to it and said, this is Bitmain and they're the evil monster pulling the strings. And maybe they said, oh, this is bad for a business if everyone thinks we're the evil flying spaghetti monster or whatever. Or I guess the flying spaghetti monster is good. I don't know. Whatever. I'm going to take credit for it. I don't know, but it totally was all my doing. We'll see what happens. We'll see whether their miners adopt it. We'll see whether they ship it, whether they ship Stratum V2 or some proprietary protocol. Who knows? But potentially huge.
It's massive. And can you, if you don't mind, just for folks that may be hearing this and saying what's the big deal anyway? Why does it matter that miners can choose what transactions go in the block? Why does that why can't the pool just do it? What is the actual reason why that makes a difference?
Yeah, so I think we were talking about this censorship resistance property. The way Bitcoin intends to get or intended to always get censorship resistance, intended to always have this property that you don't have to trust anyone else in order to be able to transact your Bitcoin, was that hash rate and mining was supposed to be decentralized. It was supposed to be that there are a lot of miners all around the world, and anytime you want to get your transaction included, you just have to find one that wants to mine your transaction. Hopefully many do, but you really just have to find one with enough hash rate to regularly mine blocks, and that there are enough miners who have enough hash rate to regularly mine blocks that is not hard. That is not the case when the miners, the things who have to pick the transactions that go on the block, who you would have to go to get your transaction mined, are the pools, not the miners. Mining, ASIC ownership, these farms filled with ASICs, are actually fairly decentralized. There are a lot of them, owned by a lot of different countries, companies, in a lot of different countries around the world. You know, for many practical purposes, mining is actually decentralized. A lot of people maybe don't recognize this or think that, well, there's these four big public companies in the U.S. Well, if you add up all the big public companies, public miners in the U.S., they don't actually have that much hash rate as a percentage of total hash rate around the world. And there's, you know, there's a lot in Russia and Kazakhstan and China, and like it's all over the place, right? That's really good. It's really great for Bitcoin, but the thing that needs to be decentralized is this transaction selection, is the, like, who do you have to go to get your transaction mined? And today those are pools, and pools are super centralized. So we want to take that power and give it to the decentralized group of people, rather than having it be in the centralized group where there's only three or four actual companies who are materially competitive. You are totally muted right now. And you're going to get so much shit for this later.
This is so embarrassing. Oh my gosh. what I was going to say is it is great, honestly, to see whatever Bitmain's actual motivation behind it. It's incredible to see them make that move. Like, yes. Because again, that's a huge, huge deal. And which is just kind of wild that this wasn't covered more. I blame fellow podcast bros like myself. We need to do better of covering these.
I think they like announced it Thursday afternoon on the last day of the conference when everyone was worn out and like, oh, I'm just going to go watch Ross's speech and then I'm going to go home and sleep off the hangover. Like, they announced it at the worst possible time at a side event, not even the main event. And yeah, it was like the worst announcement possible, but also one of the biggest.
That is wild. This is a slightly different note, but I'm curious where you stand on just like the ossification side of things, because I think this is something that gets, like, the word ossification gets thrown around a lot, as though it's like this decision that is made versus something that's just like this natural progression that happens. And I'm curious where you think we are at in this progression. Maybe you disagree that this is like a natural progression, but like, where do you think we are at in this? A lot of people have made the point, like, well, Bitcoin's basically, you know, already effectively ossified. Like, you don't get a choice in it. It just happens, and maybe it already kind of happened. Where do you sit on this? Where do you think we're at in that? Is Bitcoin still going to change in a material way? Does Bitcoin still need to change in a material way?
Yeah. I mean, I do think there is definitely an element of, as Bitcoin grows, it will continue to, it'll be harder to change. Changes will be less frequent. Types of changes will be less major. I think that's the case. I don't think we're there yet. You know, Bitcoin development is still very small. There's still a small group of people who work on Bitcoin full time and contribute materially to Bitcoin development. It's an ever-growing group of people, but it's still fairly small. And I think that the community of people who pay a lot of attention to Bitcoin, who really know a lot about Bitcoin, who are deeply interested in everything that's happening in Bitcoin, who are, you know, going to pay attention to the next soft fork and share an opinion and not just say, like, ah, the developers figure it out. It's still a small group of people. It's feels like a lot of people because there's a lot of people screaming on social media, and they're very loud on social media, but it's still not a big group of people. And so I don't think we're very far down the ossified direction. I know there's a lot of people who think we are a ways down that direction because it feels to them like, well, there's no changes happening in Bitcoin, and the changes that are getting proposed aren't getting adopted, and yada yada. I think that's just a consequence of developers being busy with other stuff. You know, I talked about mempool and these big changes happening in Bitcoin Core. It's like, okay, well, developers are busy with lots of other things going on, and in part as a consequence, they're not working on a lot of soft forks, they're kind of look at various soft forks proposals and they're like, yeah, okay, that might move the needle on some stuff, but not a huge deal. It's not like fundamentally re-architecting Bitcoin or fundamentally enabling new things as much as some proponents claim. They're generally not. And so people are like, yeah, okay, we'll get to that. And so I think it's easy to read too much into the fact that there aren't many changes, haven't been many changes to Bitcoin lately. And I don't think people should read that much into that. I think, you know, we'll see what happens, but I don't think we need to read too much into that. And yeah, I mean, I think we'll get to an ossification point. I hope we're not there yet. I don't think we're even really all that close to there yet. But yeah.
Do you, in terms of like how you view Bitcoin development more broadly, as it encompasses layer two, three, whatever development, is it, what's your view on that in terms of where kind of like, where does the quote, to use a just buzzword, innovation happen in terms of the user experience? Like it would seem that that happens on these, you know, on the layer twos, on the Lightnings, or going whatever layer you think this is, like on the eCash side of things. Like, is that where you think a lot of this stuff happens? And maybe that's why there's not so much of an urgency behind a lot of these current proposed changes to base layer?
Yeah, in part. Certainly the various layer twos, layer two and a halves, custodial with more privacy, whatever you want to call these various systems, move a lot faster. They can. There's no, since they don't have a whole group of different people who have different stakeholders who all have to agree to any change. And so they move a lot faster. They still move slower than we'd like. Lightning still is taking a long time to get to a point where we're happy with it, but they move fast. And so that is a lot of the focus. And that's also a lot of the focus of user experience in Bitcoin. You know, where is the wallet, you know, the wallet of the future in 6 months, 8 months, 18 months, what kind of wallet are people going to be building? Well, it's not an on-chain wallet. No one's sitting down and saying, I'm going to build a new on-chain Bitcoin wallet for people to use on their phones. Okay, maybe some people have some like secure, high security, whatever, but that's not what's happening. And so the focus is really on these second layer systems. And I think you're right that but I think at the same time, that's not to discount how much work has to happen in Bitcoin Core on the on-chain side of things to enable those. There's a lot of people who would argue that we need various changes, soft fork consensus changes to Bitcoin to enable some of these L2s. I don't think that's necessarily true, but we have needed, for example, mempool policy changes, like big overhauls to the mempool in Bitcoin Core in order to enable Lightning to have a better security model and in order to enable Lightning to have a better usability story. Those changes also help Arc and other L2s too. So that's where a lot of the work in Bitcoin Core has been focused. On the soft fork side, you know, there are various proposals that would improve some L2s. I think the improvements to Lightning are moderate, but the improvements to other L2s like Arc are maybe more substantial. There's still usability, user experience questions around Arc, but most importantly, people are deploying them now without any soft fork changes. People can actually sit down and build these things. And this gives you a much better story for, okay, as Bitcoin Core finishes up some of its fairly large overhauls to the mempool, people are deploying these L2s, Lightning gets good, Arc starts getting deployed, Spark and whatever else gets deployed, and people start using these things, rollups importantly start getting deployed, then we can see, okay, well, how are these technologies being used? What does the usability look like? How are they faring in the market? Are people interested in using them? Are they really providing value? And then we can sit down and say, okay, here, you know, I think this specific technology would be 10x better if only we had this soft fork, and it's just not providing the value that it would to the ecosystem because we don't have that. But we only really learn that as we start to deploy things, as we start to actually build things. And so I think we'll get back to the soft fork game, we'll get back to it, but we'll come into it with a lot more information than we have now and with a lot ton more information than we had even 2 years ago, where a lot of these ideas like Spark, like BitVM, didn't exist. And so we were kind of flying blind with like, well, we should do this soft fork to get this set of features. Like, okay, well, we don't know how to use that. Now we have ideas for how to use it. Now we can sit down and say, okay, how do we actually want it to look? Because we have ideas for how to use it, and we have these systems that people are actually even building, and we're going to see how they're going to work.
More like practical versus just purely theoretical and saying, hey, this sounds nice. Like, which is ultimately you're going to get more buy-in from people if that's the case as well. Like, if you're just throwing
Totally.
out theoretical ideas, like nobody wants to hear about your theoretical idea that sounds cool. Like, but if you have something in practice, that's a different story.
And I think that was a huge reason why things haven't happened, is they just didn't generate excitement because they were theoretical. And even the practical ideas that people proposed were like still too theoretical. And now there's like this real practical stuff. It's like, okay, I can see this. I can see how people are building it. I can see why people are building it. We can see how people use it. And now it's like, okay, well, now we really should do this or that, and we should tweak it slightly because it would help this a little more and whatever.
Be conscious of your time here, Matt. And I want to give another shout out to people to go to saveourwallets.org. I'm gonna do it myself. I was gonna try and get the call made before we hopped on here, but I did not yet. But you have my word that I will make my voice heard to my elected representatives. And I would encourage people to do this because it's genuinely such a like it'll take 5 minutes of your day. And if you can't spend 5 minutes to, you know, to do a little something for Bitcoin, well, like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, go
I
use the
mean, you just
dollar.
listened to an hour and a half podcast. You can pick up the
Exactly.
phone for 5 minutes. You clearly have the time.
Exactly. That's the best argument. If you're listening to 40 hours of podcasts per week, you can take 5 minutes and go and go call your elected official. And I think this is important too, because people, I think, sometimes want to like reject the political establishment entirely and say, well, we just don't even need to pay attention to them. We don't need to do it. And that's fine. You can feel that way. But the, you know, it's like you may not care about politics, but politics cares about you. And
Yeah.
these lawmakers are going to make laws that you do not like and do not benefit you and do not make you more free because they're, you know, laws, if you don't stand up and say something. So in this case, where it's a nice, simple, a bill that just allows developers to actually develop without the fear of incarceration, I think that's something that everyone should be able to get behind. So thank
Yeah.
you. Anything else you want to, anywhere else you want to send people besides saveourwallets.org?
No, that's the big one. Yeah, saveourwallets.org. You can type your zip code. You can put in your email. You're just giving me your email. We might send you an email. We might not send you an email. In fact, if nothing interesting happens, we won't send you an email. We're not going to use it to spam you. It's just going in the database. Maybe we'll share it with MailChimp or something. But hopefully they don't get hacked again. Hopefully. But just type in your zip code. We proxy it for you. We don't log anything. It's all anonymized. You're fine. Just call your reps. Saveourwallets.org. It's not complicated. Spend 5 minutes. Help Bitcoin.
It's a great pitch, and also the website's very nice. It was designed by the Bitcoin design community, yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole community of people whose job it is now to just make Bitcoin look better. They're awesome. One of the people in that community stood up. And, you know, I said like, hey, I think we need to promote this BRCA bill a little better. And one of them raised their hand and said like, yeah, I can do that. And so they sat down, designed it. They had an LLM actually turn it into real code. It's great what these things can do. And yeah, now we have a website.
I love it. Just designing it and then vibe coding it into existence. It's a
Right.
beautiful thing. Well, Matt, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. Thanks for all the work that you do. And looking forward to another banger of a presentation from you at some point. I'll link a couple of these old ones so people can check them out because they are quite good.
Thanks.
And that's a wrap on this Bitcoin Talk episode of the Bitcoin Podcast. Remember to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're watching or listening, and share it with your friends, family, and strangers on the internet. Find me on Nostr at primal.net/walker and this podcast at primal.net/titcoin. On X, YouTube, and Rumble, just search at Walker America. And find this podcast on X and Instagram at Titcoin Podcast. Head to the show notes to grab sponsor links. Head to substack.com/@WalkerAmerica to get episodes emailed to you. And head to bitcoinpodcast.net for everything else. Bitcoin is scarce, but podcasts are abundant. So thank you for spending your scarce time listening to the Bitcoin Podcast. Until next time, stay free.